Hey, welcome to your turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us. And I have a very interesting show today. It's again, we're following the money. In this case, it's money you don't want to lose to a lawsuit as a result of your federal job. My guests are David Kavanaugh. He is on the business side, and John P. Mahoney, who is partner and chair of the Federal Employment Law for Tully Rinkney Law Group. And this, we're talking to people. This is a new product called FedGuard, and they're joining the market. David, who are the other people that are in the professional liability business?
There's a couple
Wright and Company.
Companies. There's a Wright USA. There's the Fed, and there's also Mass Benefits.
Okay, and get the obvious questions out of the way. Why would I, as a federal worker, need professional liability insurance? I mean, the government's going to take care of me, right?
Of course. We all knew that. The biggest question is, why would you need it? And the biggest answer is because the things you don't think will happen probably will happen. Many times, even in just a small situation at work where somebody doesn't like the way you're acting, and all of a sudden somebody's coming and knocking on your door and saying, we've got to investigate these charges against you. And essentially, the enemy is within. That's really what we're talking about. Because most of the times with a professional liability for federal employees policy, the claims come from the administrative procedures, which means everything is happening from within the government, not from without.
Well, of course, I always thought, and I guess a lot of people thought, that liability insurance would be, I'm an IRS agent or something to do with my job, and an outside person or force comes in to sue me. But you're saying most of these are in-house cases.
Over 90% of the claims that we've handled over the years have to do with administrative procedures or inside the government situations, which is why so many people don't understand that something can happen to them, and it really does become a big problem for them. It becomes a big problem from protecting their career, their reputation, their integrity, and as you were talking about following the money, how much you could lose in having to defend yourself in a situation like this, because the biggest problem is when that little knock comes on the door and says, we have to investigate this, somebody stands there and says, oh, my Lord, what do I do now? And that's what FedGuard's there for. They don't have to worry about that. When that little knock comes on the door, they just call FedGuard, because we're able to take and put in their hands the team that will extract them as best we can, given the circumstances, from that kind of a circumstance.
Well,
that's the important thing.
Is this the kind of thing where somebody would say, I'm the boss or I'm the manager, that I've created a hostile work environment? Is it that the realm thing we're talking about here, or a sexual harassment allegation?
It's that, but it's also anything that anybody says against you while you're doing your job. That's the biggest thing. The best analogy I could give you is that doctors have their malpractice, lawyers have their malpractice, boards of directors have their malpractice. Federal employees should have a equivalent of a malpractice, which is a professional liability for while they're doing their job. It really becomes a career 911, because there are people who have never had a problem and they've gone 30 years into federal service, and all of a sudden, boom, up comes something from who knows where. And all of a sudden, they're starting to have to dig into their pockets. What we say is, for less than $300 a year, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, for less than $300 a year, somebody can essentially indemnify themselves to make sure that they have quality representation at a time when they need it the most, and they don't have to sit there and go it alone, if you will, because there's nothing worse than having to do something and you know nothing about it.
Is there a situation or a time where you wouldn't represent me even though I had a policy?
There probably is, and it would depend on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. It may be an invalid claim. It could be something that where you were doing something and it is deemed not to be within the scope of your duty, but you thought it was. that's about the only time
okay.
that we wouldn't. But I'm not ruling out that there wouldn't be some time when a claim could be denied.
John, before the show, we were talking about the different types of lawsuits, and you mentioned criminal, administrative, and civil, or actions. Explain what each of those are, would you?
Sure. Federal employees, even acting within the scope of their federal employment, can sometimes run afoul of criminal laws. So, for example, if you're an FBI agent or some other law enforcement agent, and your job is to arrest people, you know, those folks face what we call Bivens constitutional claims, where the suspect or the arrestee can turn around and sue them for violations of their constitutional rights or criminal issues if they believe they were, you know, treated too harshly physically by the agent. And the FedGuard policy would provide up to $2 million of liability damage coverage. So if the person is successfully sued for liability, the policy would, you know, pay up to $2 million for those types of judgments. And also, sometimes federal employees can be sued for torts, meaning, you know, negligence, meaning, you know, if they get into a car accident, they're driving a GOV, for example, and they get into a car accident, the member of the public, the victim, can turn around and sue that federal employee and the government for that negligent operation of that GOV that led to bodily injury. The policy would cover up to, you know, $2 million of liability if you purchase that level of coverage for tort or negligent situations. The biggest issue, as Dave had mentioned previously, is the administrative misconduct coverage. If a federal employee is either, you know, hauled up onto the Hill and investigated by Congress, or if they're subjected to an inspector general investigation or an internal affairs investigation, or even an investigation by their management, the policy will kick in and provide up to $200,000 of coverage and will assign an attorney. You know, our firm has been selected by FedGuard to be the policy lawyers that would represent the federal employees who needed coverage, and we would represent them, and the policy would take care of our legal fees, which is a big comfort for a federal employee who's under investigation or facing disciplinary charges.
David, it didn't go unnoticed when I asked you that. I said, won't the government help you? And you laughed. You're ha. What do you mean by that? I mean, I assume that when a federal worker is called up on the Hill, that in most cases the government would say, okay, we're going to pay your salary, we'll send a lawyer with you. Is that not so?
No, unfortunately, it isn't, because when you get in a situation like that and all of a sudden it's an adverse situation, then you wind up pretty much on your own. So there has to be some representation. And the way the policy is set up is that even if there is a government lawyer there with you, you may in recent months or years have experienced what we would call scapegoating, if you will, where someone's been set up to be the sacrificial lamb because all of a sudden this isn't looking good for us, so we've got to lay it off on someone. So this policy would also provide you with an attorney so that they would be able to shadow what the U.S. attorney's doing and hopefully head off a scapegoating where everything would be laid on that individual.
I guess a recent example of that was the Internal Revenue Service individuals. I believe they were all based in Cincinnati. Correct me if I'm wrong. But that was the unit that looked over the tax-exempt status of political groups, and the allegation was that they were giving conservative groups, pro-Republican groups, Tea Party groups, a hard time. Now, what category would those people come under in this case?
In that particular case, if they made a claim under our policy, we would be in there and be doing a damn good job for them to make sure that they're not going to be just hoisted on their own petard, if you will. Because, yes, I mean, it was I believe the quote was something in the congressional hearing was something like, oh, that must have been a couple renegades out in Cincinnati. And it just the cavalier attitude of something like that, when somebody is really doing their job and what they have been told to do, and all of a sudden they're just stripped naked if you will.
Sure. What happens ultimately is if the federal employee's interests are aligned with the federal agency's interest, the agency will typically assign an agency lawyer to represent them, quote unquote, before the investigatory body, in this case Congress. But if the employee's interests, personal interests, are not in aligned with the agency, or if there's a political reason why the agency doesn't want to stick its neck out to provide representation for the employee in the investigation, then the employee is on his or her own. They really need to get their own lawyer. And I can tell you, we're expensive. And yeah. So, you know, to represent someone in an MSPB appeal of discipline, for example, can cost $100,000 or more out of the employee's own pocket. And if you've been fired, you know, if the action that you're appealing is a termination, you don't have an income during the time period that you're appealing that adverse action. So folks have to get that money out of their own pocket, or oftentimes they dip into their TSP retirement accounts, take loans on their retirement accounts to pay their attorneys. And so not only do they lose their income, but they also lose part of their retirement. And if, you know, if they had the FedGuard policy, they would be provided an attorney to represent them, and the policy would pay the attorney's fees, and the person would then save, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I can't imagine the trauma, the personal nightmare that would be. You're fired, or you lose your job, or you're accused of something, and then you have to dip into your own savings, if you have any, to do this. You can see why some people go crazy doing this.
Sure. It's very stressful. I consult with federal employees every day, and I've done so for over 20 years. And I can tell you, you know, just recently I've met with, you know, some federal employees who had are long-term federal employees, 25 years in service, 30 years in service, have never been disciplined before, and they walk in my door with a proposed removal or a proposed demotion over some alleged misconduct, and they've never heard of the professional liability coverage. So when I tell them, you know, if they had to litigate their case and defend their career all the way through a United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit case, they could be looking at spending $200,000. And they look at me and say, well, where am I going to get that money? I'm about to lose my income. And I say, well, some people take TSP loans, some people borrow from their friends or get a loan, bank loan. But it's not an easy thing to deal with, on top of the fact that you may be out, you know, maybe losing your job and losing your income after 20 years.
On that sad note, we're going to have to take a short break here, but we'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with David Cavanaugh and John P. Mahoney. They are with FedGuard, and it's a new organization that's offering professional liability insurance to federal workers. It's new, although you've both been in the business a long, long time.
That is correct. John's been doing it for over 20 years, and I've been associated with the professional liability for federal employees for over 15 years.
During the break, the magic word, Edward Snowden, came up, the now famous, infamous, depending on your point of view, a guy who's currently living in somewhere in Russia, probably in Moscow. He had worked as a contractor for the National Security Agency, and before that, I believe he had been an employee of the Central Intelligence Agency. So he may have been an employee at one time, was a contractor at one time. What would his status be? Could he have purchased one of these policies?
Well, certainly, you know, the employees of the intelligence agencies, the government employees of the CIA and the DIA and NSA and the other alphabet soup security agencies, this policy would certainly cover them for, you know, criminal liability, civil liability, and also administrative defense against disciplinary actions. And because intelligence community employees do not have Merit System Protection Board appeal rights, professional liability insurance is particularly important for them because they're stuck with an in-house review of whether they did what the agency said they did, and they particularly need strong representation. So, you know, I recommend the professional liability insurance to the members of the intelligence community. But in terms of federal contractors, right now there is no professional liability insurance that would provide them protection from discipline. You know, they work for private companies. You know, I know the FedGuard folks at Citadel are considering, you know, developing a policy that would cover contractors. But, you know, the issue for the contractors really is that when Congress stripped out of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act the provisions that would provide a method for contractors to blow the whistle lawfully, it really left people like Snowden without a legal way to blow the whistle. So, you know, he's stuck between a rock and a hard place, whether he's a criminal, you know, whether he's engaged in espionage or whether he's really, you know, he's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. So there are folks who consider him to be a hero. So, you know, he's stuck in the no man's land of not really having professional liability insurance coverage right now. So, you know, I wish him much luck if he's able to work out a deal with the United States. Otherwise, he'll probably go to jail for quite some time.
Or spend the rest of his life in Russia. We mentioned the Merit Systems Protection Board. When an ordinary federal worker goes before the board for whatever reason, is that an expensive process?
It sure is. It's very similar to court litigation. Once you file an MSPB appeal, you have discovery rights, like you're in court, you know, to send written interrogatories and document requests and admission requests to the agencies. The agency, if it involves a medical situation, can do an independent medical examination as part of discovery. And there are depositions where, you know, I would depose the government's witnesses and they would depose my client and his or her witnesses. And depositions in and of themselves can cost $3,000 to $5,000 in attorney's fees per person. So, you know, realistically, going all the way through an MSPB hearing and the petition for review appeals process, you know, the average federal employee case can cost $50,000 to $100,000 in attorney's fees. And without the professional liability insurance policy, the appellant, the employee, is paying for those fees out of his or her own pocket.
Do you find, or would you even know, how many people, you know, I think some people think this is like going on Judge Judy. I go in, state my case, and get a ruling, and, you know, Bob's your uncle. But in fact, I hadn't thought of the depositions and that sort of thing. But if you, when you get into this process, do people ever run away, back out?
Sure. A lot of people run out of money, frankly, before they get their day in court. And, you know, in some sense, the government is counting on that. They realize that, you know, the average federal employee's salary is not going to, you know, cover $100,000, $150,000 in attorney's fees. So if they, you know, just paper the heck out of the case and, you know, file motions after motions after motions, eventually, you know, most federal employees are going to run out of money before they actually get to the hearing.
I would think virtually all of them would. I mean, I don't see how hardly any case could go through if it's talking about $100,000.
Yeah, and what we end up doing is trying to be very lean and very efficient in terms of how we litigate the case to try to stretch out the person's finances in order to carry them to the hearing. But the problem with, you know, doing it on the cheap is that you're not really strongly and zealously litigating the case, and sometimes you really need to do that in order to be successful. So it's always a balancing act between, you know, over litigating the case and under litigating the case. And with professional liability insurance, that those issues are taken care of. You know, the policy covers up to $200,000 of attorney's fees, which is certainly sufficient to cover the average MSPB appeal. So you can actually litigate the case properly, and the employee doesn't have to worry about where they're coming up with that $200,000 out of their own pocket or their retirement finances. So the professional liability insurance policy, I think, is really a career saver.
Back in the day, there was no such thing as professional liability insurance, and Jerry Shaw, old and dear friend, and Bill Bransford of Shaw Bransford Roth sort of carried the ball for this. Ran it through the Congress. It took 6 or 8 years, as I recall, but they finally got the Congress to agree that the U.S. government, and correct me if I'm wrong, would pay, I think it was approximately half or maybe exactly half of the total premium for law enforcement, LEOs and people like
managers,
that.
Supervisors, and federal law enforcement.
Oh, so that many people. That's a lot of people.
And that's a lot of people. And at that particular point in time, they were thinking that that was really the group of people that probably would have the most targets put on their back or front or forehead or whatever you want to call it. Really what we're talking about here is economics. If you don't boil it down to anything else, you want to boil it down to economics. Because if you use a LEO or a manager or a supervisor as an example, this policy costs less than $300 a year for $1 million worth of liability coverage and $200,000 of administrative legal fees. You can't, as a manager, supervisor, or law enforcement officer, totally ignore or overlook the aspect of, for a net cost, after my reimbursement from my agency, which they're mandated to do, for less than $150 a year, I can have the career protection that I'm talking about. But more importantly, not the career protection, but my wallet protection. Because, like John said, even if it was $50 or $100,000 of legal fees that you have to come up with, how can you stack up $50 or $25,000 against less than $150 on an annual basis?
That's astounding. You know, you would think, given if people thought like that, that half the people in government would have it. I take it that's not the case.
Well, it isn't the case, and it's one of the reasons why we are starting the program that we're starting is so many people. John said it earlier. He's had people come into his office, and he says, do you have the liability insurance? And they say, what liability insurance? Yeah. So our entire thrust right now is to have people understand that the danger is there. If you will, the shark's in the water, and you're swimming in the water that the shark is in. So if you can know about the program and then make the decision that you're going to do something to protect yourself financially as well as career-wise, then why not do it?
Did I hear, read, or see somewhere that only about 40,000 people in the government have professional liability insurance?
You know, we don't have any real hard facts as far as numbers are concerned, but it's a pretty good guesstimate on how many people within the federal government currently do have the coverage.
And would the majority of them be those people in the class where the government pays half their premium, the law enforcement types, the managers, the supervisors?
Yes, they would.
So very few people are shelling out $300 or whatever it is on their own.
Right.
Maybe they should.
But John said it earlier. You protect your home. Yeah. You protect your car. You indemnify yourselves in those situations. Why wouldn't you do it for your career? How can you not do that?
Well, you know, as a young reporter and then later on being a columnist for the Washington Post, before security got so tight, you know, people could just come in and out. And I don't know, I'd be visited a couple of times a week by somebody, a man or a woman. They always had a shopping bag or a thing full of documents, and some of them were in really bad shape physically and mentally. And it was often about a job situation. They claimed driven out or charged unfairly, and you didn't know whether these people were disturbed, and if so, whether they were disturbed before they got, and that's why they got fired, or whether this process drove them mad.
Yeah, sure. You know, when you look at it sort of in a constitutional context, we all treasure our lives first and foremost, and then our liberty secondarily. But our property, including our employment, is really the third most important thing we have in terms of our civil rights. And, you know, we're dealing with federal employees who have dedicated their professional careers to public service. And, you know, as a lawyer, you know, I can't do my job without professional liability insurance. And in my professional legal opinion, having represented thousands of federal employees over 20 years, it is so critical that federal employees protect their careers and insure their careers like they do their cars and their homes by having professional liability insurance.
And it's a lot cheaper than auto insurance. Trust
me. It sure is.
You mentioned you've been doing this for 20 years. You must have some great war stories. Can you share any of them with us? Obviously not revealing the name of the client, but just situations.
Sure, sure. I mean, I remember working under the policy previously, and if we remember the Elian Gonzalez case,
sure,
back in the 90s.
Jackbooted thugs,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I had been contacted by the Justice Department because, as I said before, one of their high-level lawyers – you know, politically, it wasn't in the agency's political best interest to be, publicly representing that person because, you know, Gonzalez had alleged that, you know, he had done something wrong. So they reached out to me and asked me to represent that person under the insurance policy. Luckily, he had the insurance policy. And, you know, he was brought up on investigation by Congress and faced, proposed disciplinary action, and because he had the policy coverage, he had me represent him, you know, free, you know, basically just for the insurance premium he pays per year, and he was able to save his career. And he had worked for the Justice Department for decades, and it was his first, you know, alleged offense in his entire career. So luckily, because he had the coverage, he saved his career.
And that was a case, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, a little boy from Cuba, born in Cuba, but he was living in the U.S., I think, with his grandfather, and the parents or one of the parents in Cuba wanted him back, and the U.S. government felt it was obligated to return him to his parents. Was that the situation?
Yes, yep. And the family he was living with in Miami turned around and sued, you know, everyone from the president down to the janitor at DOJ in terms of, you know, having taken the child away and given him back to the Cuban parents.
Got to take a break here on federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn, Mike Causey. I'm talking with David Cavanaugh. He's on the business side, and John P. Mahoney, who is an attorney with Rinky. What do we have trouble with?
Tully Rinky.
Okay, and you were saying you have trouble getting people to say that right. But you've been in the federal employment law business for a long, long time, and offering professional liability insurance to people. And it's an eye opener to me to find out how strange this world is. And during the break, you mentioned people who let contracts in government, how they're particularly vulnerable to charges, lawsuits, things like that.
Sure. What happens at this point, you know, you're dealing with, especially after the passage of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act last year, the focus of the federal government on waste, fraud, and abuse has really churned up. And for folks who are contracting officers or, you know, in the contracting business, there are issues that can be used against them. You know, if they've got enemies within the agency, they can be accused of some kind of waste, fraud, abuse related to their contracting activities, which can put them up under administrative investigation and conduct charges. And then ultimately, too, from the outside world, if a company or contractor company loses a bid for a contract, they can turn around and file a contract appeal or make allegations of favoritism toward the contracting officers, which can lead to discipline as well. So, you know, in addition to the law enforcement officers and the managers, contracting officials really do need to have professional liability insurance coverage.
Well, you mentioned that Elian Gonzalez case, the little boy living with his grandfather in Florida, and his parents in Cuba wanted him returned, and the government, the Justice Department, initially, and I guess finally, took the part of the parents, and they literally forcibly removed the boy from the grandparent and sent him back to Cuba. But that changed from a heartrending story to it became a political football there after a while. And what happened to the attorneys and the employees involved in that? Did the Justice Department sort of disavow them?
Well, it started off with the Justice Department, what we call scoping them. If a federal employee engages in conduct within the scope of their federal employment, the government should defend them against outside lawsuits. If there's a question that arises in the litigation as to whether the person was actually officially acting within the scope of their employment, then there's a question as to whether the Justice Department is going to defend them or not defend them. And if you add on top of that political forces from outside that put political pressure on an administration, sometimes the Justice Department will make a political decision that it's not in the government's best interest to be aligned with this employee, even though, you know, in the first instance they were doing their job. So a lot of the folks who were involved in that Elian Gonzalez case were sued civilly and criminally, and also based on EEO issues, you know, race and national origin discrimination, Bivens actions. So initially justice was on their side, but there was a question as to whether they were actually going to scope them as the investigation proceeded. So justice reached out to me to represent one of their high-level lawyers and defend them against the civil actions and the criminal actions. It ultimately worked out in the end. The person kept his job, but, you know, for a good year or so, folks were really worried about, you know, whether they were going to lose their jobs or maybe go to jail.
Was he suspended or put on administrative leave?
He was put on administrative leave, yeah. And sometimes what happens when a federal employee faces discipline, while the agency is investigating whether, in fact, they did something wrong, they'll remove them from their job and place them on unlimited paid administrative leave while they're looking at it. If there's sufficient evidence to show that the person may have engaged in misconduct, then the agency can take them off of paid administrative leave and put them on an unlimited leave without pay or, you know, in some cases, an indefinite suspension, which means you're not getting paid, but you're still under investigation. I've had federal employee clients who are on administrative leave or unlimited suspension sometimes for years before they were actually charged with misconduct. And if you're on indefinite suspension, you're not getting paid for that month, those months and months and years while you're waiting for your agency to decide whether or not you're going to get a proposed disciplinary action. So in that instance, that's another reason why, you know, having professional liability insurance is so important.
David, you wanted you have some association with the Federal Employees Education Assistance Fund, FEA?
Yes, we do. Yes. And the reason that we do is because much like the federal employee liability insurance is not that well known, many people may know of FEA, but they may not understand what and how FEA does what they do. And the reason that we've teamed up with FEA is so that we can help federal employees become more educated. And FEA does nothing but give back to the federal employee world. And people should understand that when they have an opportunity to make any kind of a contribution to FEA, to understand that at some point in time what FEA does will come back to them or their federal.
Yeah. Well, they just set up a special fund to honor Bill Bransford.
Yes, they did.
Which is nice. Listen, I thank you both for being here. Hope to visit with you again. We need to take a short break, and I'm going to be talking with Sean Riley and Andy Medici from the Federal Times. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. I just had a good visit talking about professional liability insurance. Now we're going to switch over to things that are happening directly in federal agencies. We have Andy Medici on the line and Sean Riley on the line. Gents, are you there?
We are here.
Yes, hey, thank you. Thank you for coming on. Well, I know Lauren Larson, our producer, tracked you down, but always wonder about the telephone lines in weather like this. Hey, Andy, we got to get the B word out of the way, and it must be said, buyouts. What's the situation?
Well, actually, you know, there are a couple agencies that have sort of changed activities on that, but actually I'd like to toss that to Sean. He's been doing a lot of work on buyouts in the last few days.
Well, I think one of the big ones that's that appears to be coming up is at the EPA. This is an agency that's already significantly reduced its workforce through attrition. But a month or two ago, the deputy administrator said that essentially they need to look at a different approach, and so they, according to one of the unions that represents EPA employees, they're getting ready or waiting approval, if they haven't already gotten it, from the Office of Personnel Management to offer buyouts to perhaps, you know, again, according to the union, perhaps that aimed at reducing the workforce by about 1,000 employees. This would primarily be aimed at sort of the upper grade employees, GS-13 through GS-15, you know, intended to do a sort of more comprehensive restructuring of the workforce to rebalance it, quote-unquote, for future needs, you know, in a way that a hiring freeze or a partial hiring freeze wouldn't allow you to do.
And what about other agencies? Emily Kopp this morning was reporting about the Broadcasting Board of Governors.
That one I'm not familiar with. I've heard about it, but I can't discuss it in detail.
Okay, and then you have places, too, like Social Security, that are offering people early retirement but not a buyout. Could you explain the difference?
Oh, sure. Well, the buyout is, you know, the buyout is a cash incentive. It can be up to, up to $25,000. And it's, and, you know, clearly an incentive to encourage employees to leave. An early retirement package, you know, voluntary early retirement or VERA, you know, essentially relaxes the standard age and service requirements that you would typically need, to retire, to let you out a little bit early, get you off the payroll.
Okay, and then the
without an incentive.
Yeah, what we found in statistically is that when an agency offers an early retirement without a buyout to sweeten it, that they get very few takers.
Yeah, you know, the Postal Service is probably the best example of that. You know, they've resorted repeatedly, and they're, you know, some have gotten considerable media attention, some have basically gone unannounced or without much publicity, but they have been constantly been offering early outs and buyouts over the last couple of years. And typically, you're absolutely correct, the early outs, you know, without a cash incentive, the turnout or the acceptance rate is going to be much, much lower. They tried a year or so ago, I think, to offer just an early retirement package to postal supervisors, and the response rate was, to put it kindly, anemic.
Yeah. Yeah, and even though the buyouts is after deductions, it's but it's $16,000 to $18,000, and that was that's a 1996 figure. That's or mid 1990s when the buyout started. But there's been no movement in Congress to sweeten the amount of the buyout, has there?
No, there hasn't. That's a good point. But yeah, it has not changed in quite a while, and or you know, there's really been no adjustment made for inflation. So I find it interesting. You know, as you know, you lose about close to a third of the buyout through taxes. Right, yeah. Off the top, that the you know it does have, but it does have a significant impact on willingness of employees to leave.
Yeah, Andy, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm actually had a story out about how the postal IG has sort of recommended that the post office should pursue sort of financial products as a way to help generate revenue. The idea being that there are a lot of payday lenders and a lot of check cashing services that take a lot off the top, and that the Postal Service can sort of undercut those and offer a lot of customers, a lot of people those sorts of products, and bring in billions of dollars of revenue every year to help make up some of those shortfalls.
Well, I know in many foreign countries the post office acts as a bank, doesn't it?
Yeah, in a lot of countries, the Postal Service doesn't just, you know, mail and deliver packages. They offer banking services. You know, some postal services even, you know, offer cell phone services, prepayments, those sorts of things. And a lot of countries, that sort of diversified approach allows them to sort of stay much more solvent in the long run.
Is that the kind of thing the IG was talking about?
Yeah, the IG was talking a lot about sort of those banking services that a lot of underserved populations use, like prepaid cards, loadable cards, as well as some basic online banking services and check cashing services that the Postal Service can do sort of at volume and offer much, much lower rates than what you would normally see on any, you know, on any given strip mall or check cashing location.
What's the status in this, the Postal Service wanting to put post offices into some of these big box stores, and I forget whether it was Target or Sam's Club or one of those, but they was going to be staffed with regular employees as opposed to postal workers.
I think that's still in flux. I believe it was at Staples they were looking
Staples,
at.
Staples, that's
yeah.
Right.
And I think there's I believe that, you know, there's been some protest by unions representing postal workers, essentially saying this is infringement of the contract, that you're bringing in non-postal workers to do postal type functions. But I'm not sure exactly. I'm not sure that's been completely resolved at this point.
Is the post office, postal service, still talking about things like setting up their own health insurance program?
They're still talking about it, I think, but I'm not sure if anyone's listening. I believe there's still scheduled to be what they call a markup in a Senate committee tomorrow on postal legislation that I believe would allow the Postal Service to have that option to negotiate it with, you know, give them the go ahead to negotiate about it with unions. But I think the outlook for any kind of comprehensive postal reform is growing steadily dimmer, just because, ironically, the Postal Service is doing better financially. Incidentally, it's going to announce its first quarter fiscal 14 results on Friday. And the better things look, relatively speaking anyhow, the harder it will be to get any political traction to make any tough decisions about its future in Congress.
And the Postal Service keeps arguing that because it has to pre-fund the retirement program, that's what sets it apart from other federal agencies, and that's what accounts for so much of its loss, right?
Yeah, and actually, what its unions particularly emphasize that point, that a lot, that the Postal Service, if you take away that legally required pre-funding requirement, which I don't think it's unique to the Postal Service, but it is unusual, that if you took that away, they'd actually be doing okay, or, you know, at least coming close to breaking even. But the Postal Service says, you know, that they have a severe, they're constantly being threatened by a cash crunch, that they only have a week or two of cash on hand, which is not what you want when you're a $65 billion a year organization with 500,000 employees.
Not a good thing. Lauren Larson, our producer, wanted me to ask you about changes in the combined federal campaign. Combined Federal Campaign, I guess most people know what it is, but it is one of the biggest charitable organizations in the country, probably maybe even in the world. What's coming up with there?
Well, we got a copy yesterday. You know, OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, has been working on some revisions to the campaign based on, in part, on recommendations that were made by an advisory commission 2 years ago. And we got a copy of a draft of the final regulations, which many in the CFC community expect to be published in the Federal Register fairly soon. And they would amount to some major changes in how the campaigns run. For example, charities would have to pay an application fee for the first time, you know, if they wanted to participate. Paper pledges would be phased out over 5 years, with that schedule starting in 2015, so presumably through 2019, in favor of electronic giving. The principal combined fund organizations, which most people don't know what those are, but those are the organizations that, like United Ways, that work for the CFC under contract. Those are usually hired by local CFCs. Those would be abolished. Instead, OPM would hire what they call central campaign administrators, and there would be more flexibility about when the campaign would start. And this takes place against the backdrop of what was, I think, it's pretty widely regarded as a disastrous 2013 season, you know, that was, of course, interrupted by the shutdown in October. But the expectations are that pledges will be down by double digit, you know, percentage amount by double digits, by tens of billions of dollars.
Okay, yeah, and there in the past there's been some scandal associated with some of those organizations that CFC was using, but going to be a lot of kickback on this. Listen, thank you, folks, for being with us. We'll look forward to talking to you next Wednesday at this time. Have a good week, everybody, and buckle up.
Thanks, Mike.